Hi, I'm John Krall. Coming up on No Limits, we will talk with Police Chief Paul Soselsky about the challenges of running the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department. This conversation comes at a timely moment, just as crime statistics reveal that, while overall crime in Indianapolis has dropped, the number of aggravated assaults, which is considered an indicator of the true level of violence in a community, is on the rise. Both Mayor Greg Ballard and Melina Kennedy, his Democratic opponent in this year's mayor's race, have made it clear that the linked issues of crime and the police department will be part of their ongoing debate. We invite you to join the discussion about crime and the people who are supposed to stop it by calling us toll-free at 1-866-476-3881. You also can email us at nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. If you have wanted to ask the police chief a question, this is your chance. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are fortunate today to be able to talk with Police Chief Paul Soselsky. Chief Soselsky, welcome to the program. It's good to have you here.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
We are. I would like to invite our listeners to join this conversation. If you have wanted an opportunity to talk to the police chief, this is it. So please consider calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, let's talk a little bit. Let's get started right now. And we've had both Mayor Ballard and his Democratic opponent, Melina Kennedy, on the program in the past few weeks. And they've both indicated that crime and basically the police department are going to be issues in this campaign. I'd like to ask sort of two questions to get us started. What does that make your job more difficult to be the center of a community discussion like that? And does it make it more difficult for the police officers?
Well, I would like to say that the answer is no. I mean, regardless of the political season, our job is to make the city of Indianapolis the safest that we can. And, every day our officers are out there working very hard. It's hot, but they're still out there. When it's cold, they're out there every day, and crime is going down. And that's one of the things that, I'd really like to be able to chance to talk about today is, we are doing a very good job out there. The officers are working hard. Each district, we have great community support. The community policing efforts that we're doing in terms of engaging the community and talking with them every day, getting them involved on the districts to help solve crime in the neighborhood, it's working.
And what are the things that lead you to believe that it's working? You mentioned the crime statistics that just were released, and there are some very hopeful signs in there.
Sure. Yeah, and they were good, but they need to be better. When I was first appointed chief, I said in my speech, I want double-digit crime reduction. Well, we're not there yet. But the good thing is that they are going down, and that's always a positive thing as long as they keep going that direction. Last year we had a low number of homicides in many years, and we're below last year's rate right now. There's a lot of things that go into that, but part of it is good police work. Part of it is working with the community. And, when you said, how do I know that's working? Well, again, I think you can talk to any of our district commanders and see the level of support that we have when we have community meetings or the task force meetings in our districts. Yesterday, I was at the Northwest District Community Day, and it was packed with people. So, people are engaging with their police department and becoming involved in their neighborhoods.
Well, the crime statistics that were released did indicate that overall crime is going down in the city. And in fact, in some areas, actually, the drops were larger than the national average, that overall crime is dropping across the country. The one troubling indicator, truly troubling one, was the fact that the number of aggravated assaults seems to be climbing. What accounts for that, do you think?
Well, I think a number of things.
We ought to take a step back and explain to people. Not everyone speaks this jargon. Right. What an aggravated assault!
Right,
is.
And that's what I was going to say. There are several things. I mean, if I pick up a trash can in an argument and throw it at you and hit you with it, that could be an aggravated assault. So it doesn't mean that somebody got shot and didn't die, although that certainly also is an aggravated assault. So it could be a number of things. It could be a bar fight where a guy picks up a bar bottle or a beer bottle and cracks you over the head. That's an aggravated assault. So a lot of those crimes that fall in that category are personal relationship things that maybe even happen inside. A domestic violence incident, if a husband picks up something in the house and, again, hits his wife with it and is arrested for battery, that is an aggravated assault. So, again, it doesn't necessarily mean that because aggravated assaults are going up, that means we have more violence on our streets. Certainly, again, these crimes are occurring. So, you know, we break it down also into the gun-related aggravated assaults, which are a little higher. And, you know, again, maybe that's one reason why our homicide rate is low. As I think it was said in the paper, you know, good medical care, bullet placement, all those things do come into play. Get somebody to the hospital faster and they don't die, it's an aggravated assault. It's not a homicide. But, you know, I can tell you that we look at those stats daily. You know, where are they occurring? Where are the aggravated assaults occurring? Where are even the shots fired occurring? Because we could have a shots fired incident where no one's even hit. But that doesn't mean – but again, so we track that in terms of there's some type of violence occurring in this neighborhood.
Does that – let me interrupt for just – does that mean that you review them on a daily basis? You know, is that part of like the way you start your day, take a look at the numbers from the previous –
I review them more on a global scale. The district commanders and every district has a crime strategist that will be looking at those daily, weekly, monthly to see not only what happened last night, but how the week pattern is happening and how the pattern is happening in a month. And that's how they decide where their hotspots are and how to deploy the resources that they have on the district. You know, we've had a lot of talk in the last 2 years, really, since almost 2 years since I've been the chief, about hotspot policing. I mean, there are very small pockets of areas throughout the city where the majority of the crime is occurring. And that's how we use that data. We look at those incidents to make sure that we're putting our resources in the right places.
What accounts, and I think I pulled you off point there for a second. What accounts for the increase, do you think, in the number of aggravated assaults? I mean, I know we've got some answers that were in the Star article, some people advanced opinions, but you're the one closest to it.
You know, I guess in my 25 years of policing experience, you know, things have just changed over time. And I do believe that, you know, 20 years ago, people would solve their differences with fists. And now they're picking up guns. You know, some of the incidents that we investigate, I mean, it's senseless why someone shoots somebody over an argument, over a girl, over a car, over something, you know. So, I mean, those incidences of violence are occurring more frequently for really no reason. The population's growing here in Marion County, so that could account for part of it, you know, with more people. Obviously, you're going to have more incidents of violence. So that could be any number of things.
What's the solution, you think, to bringing down the number?
Well, good policing is certainly one solution, but it's not the only solution. I say that all the time wherever I go. You know, we cannot arrest ourselves out of the crime problem. That is one part of it, but it is not the only thing. In terms of criminal justice, we need a strong prosecutor who helps us put these cases together and presents a good case in court. We need the jails to have room to put people who then are convicted. We need judges that are, you know, able and willing to listen to these cases. But we also need a good community who becomes witnesses, who calls the police and gives us information. So it's and then on the other side, too, we have like the reentry piece. Let's face it, there's some people who belong in jail. They do something and they need to be in jail. But then there's also people who commit a crime and, quite frankly, they deserve a second chance. So I think that's a big piece of it, too, that as a society, you know, we can't just worry about arresting people. We have to worry also about when they come out of jail and provide them with education or jobs or the tools to be successful once they return.
We have not seen too many specifics yet on Melina Kennedy's sheet. Had a press conference and announcement this morning about her crime package, but one of the reference points seems to be sort of cracking down on the flow of weapons in the city. Is part of the problem that guns are too readily available? You'd mentioned that, you know, 20 years ago people would solve something with their fists, which we probably as mature human beings would say still isn't the best way to deal with a problem. That's still a crime, but it escalates if there are weapons available.
Yeah, they are. They're readily available anywhere. And I can assure you, I don't have those numbers with me today, but I mean, I can assure you that that is one of our focus. Guns, gangs, and drugs are always our focus. And, you know, we recover guns off the street daily. You don't don't hear about in the news all the time, but we do. You know, I was at a shooting scene last summer. It was a non-fatal shooting scene, and it was interesting when people found out I was a chief. They kind of swarmed me and were talking to me, asking kind of questions. So I asked, because there was juveniles involved in that particular shooting, and so I asked, I said, well, where does a 16-year-old get a gun? And they all just kind of laughed and said, anywhere you want. Give me 10 minutes and we'll go get you one. And I said, well, then tell me where they are, because I'll go get them. And of course, you know, they're not going to do that right then and there. So, you know, we always talk about avenues, how to do that anonymously, how to help the police. And that's the key right there. People know where to get these guns, and we need help from the community to tell us where. You know, one of the things that we've done this summer with our summer surge, as we've called it, you know, the increase in the crime fighting initiatives for the summer is in the past, when we would make a gun arrest for someone who is illegally possessing a handgun, for instance, the officer would take the gun to the property room, send the person to jail, and that would really kind of be the end of it. You know, he'd wait and get a subpoena and he'd go to court. Well, now whenever we arrest somebody for illegal possession of a handgun or whatever type of gun, we try to stretch the interview. You know, where we legally can, we ask, where, you know, where'd you get that? Can you help us? Take us to more. Can you? Are you willing to show us where you got it? Let's look at the history of this person. If they are a violent offender or they have handgun priors, can we take this case to the U.S. attorney and file federal charges instead of just state local charges? And we have been able to get some information from some of these interviews and stretch them out and. For instance, you know, go to different houses and get search warrants for things. So we're really trying to concentrate on that, not just the arrest that we're making, but how can we make a bigger impact off that arrest.
Stacy from Indianapolis has sent us a tweet that's on point here. It says, the new gun law about transporting guns, it's a new Indiana law. Do you have any comments about that? Has it helped or is it just more static?
Well, I tell you this. First of all, you know, I support and defend the Constitution every day that I come to work, and I am not against people carrying weapons or carrying guns legally. But I can also say this, you know, in the homicides that we have investigated, you know, people that are legally carrying handguns are not killing people. It's the people that are illegally possessing them. You know, I'm of the opinion the gun law should be much stricter. We should not have these lax laws that are, in my opinion, which are causing a lot of the violence, and people aren't really held accountable sometimes when they are caught illegally possessing a handgun.
What you say that the laws should be in what ways? Could you speak to that?
Mandatory sentences, perhaps. You know, again, people who have multiple arrests or multiple for convictions for illegally possessing a handgun. Again, stricter sentences. Some type of you know, reform, perhaps. I don't know. It just seems like sometimes you know, the penalties don't fit the crime.
Would you extend it? I mean, it sounds like part of what you're trying to do with the investigative work here is build the chain backwards, the chain of responsibility. That, you know, if a gun is used in a crime, you're trying not just to hold the person who held the gun responsible, but perhaps the person who gave that person the gun or sold it to him illegally.
Yeah,
or
we investigate that. Sometimes that's hard to prove. You know, if a gun, you know, anytime we recover a weapon, you know, obviously we run the serial number to see if it's stolen. You know, ballistic testing is done to see if there's anything in the system that would match another crime or things that were bullets or shell casings that were recovered from a crime scene. But, you know, for instance, if we caught a person with a gun and the gun was tested and let's just say hypothetically it came back as evidence that was used in a homicide, well, obviously it doesn't mean that person committed it. He's just carrying the gun at that time. So, you know, there's a lot of investigative work that has to follow up on that. But we do that daily.
And it sounds like, are you focusing a lot of your efforts now on finding out where the guns come from if they're illegal?
Well, again, yes. I mean, every arrest, we have undercover units that work with, potentially buying weapons, you know, undercover or looking through some of the drug trade, some of the gangs that we're investigating, you know, where are they getting their weapons? That's a big part of it, the daily work.
I'd like to invite our listeners to join this conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881, sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We are talking with Indianapolis Police Chief Paul Soselsky. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking today with Indianapolis Police Chief Paul Soselsky about crime and police issues here in the city of Indianapolis. Chief Soselsky, you'd mentioned earlier in the program that the police need the help of the community, that they need people to come forward as witnesses. One of the things that both Melina Kennedy and Greg Ballard said when they appeared on this program, and frankly, you know, one of the inaugural shows for this program was about this issue. They said that part of the challenge right now is rebuilding the trust in the police. That there have been a couple of high profile issues. Can you talk a little bit about the steps you've taken to try to get people to trust the police department?
Well, I think it's something that we don't talk about on the news every day. But I think one of the best developments that we have made since I've been the chief is the development of the new Professional Standards Division, which did not exist prior to me being the chief. It's what we would call the internal affairs branch of the past. And now we have two sides to that. We have the administrative side, which investigates, you know, just departmental violations. And then we also have the criminal side, which would investigate any allegation of an officer that's involved in criminal wrongdoing. Most of those are supervisors, and they report to a deputy chief in charge of that division. So it's created a very good, confidential, streamlined unit that investigates any allegation of misconduct against the officer. They are so thorough that they have actually exonerated officers by the fact-finding missions that they're on. So I think that's a part of it. And I'd like to, in my opinion, it's one of the best things we've done. And I think that we can police our own. That is a unit of high integrity, and they have been doing an excellent job. We have changed many policies over the last year in terms of, for example, our alcohol policy. One of the things that we do now, anytime an officer is involved in a crash, whether it's a fender bender or a total wreck, they are given a portable breath test on the scene to ensure that there is no impairment. We have done wonders to improving our training in terms of some electronic learning, our career leadership development office. We continue to send people to other departments across the country where we have heard that there are best practices occurring, so we could, for lack of a better word, go steal some good ideas and bring them back here and see how we can implement them here.
When it's intellectual, they refer to it as homage rather than theft, but that's okay.
Okay. So there's many things. And I think, one of the things that we've asked our officers to do is to engage the community. One of the best ways to rebuild trust is, and I tell the officers this every time I get a chance, whether I'm going to a roll call or anywhere else, is, that trust starts to rebuild every day that you put the uniform on. When you get in your car and when you talk to somebody, when you're sitting in a restaurant having a break and you're not even talking to anybody, the image that you are just in that uniform is what people see and what they think of the police. So it's incumbent upon all 1,600-plus officers of the IMPD to help improve the image.
And how much damage? The biggest hit was probably the Bessard episode. How much damage did that do to the police department?
In terms of image in the community?
Yeah.
I think it did a lot of damage. I mean, that was a tragedy that should have never happened. And that's been our charge in the last year to make sure that it never happens again.
And what would you say? We get – actually, as I say, in that first program, that was one of the focuses. That issue was still very fresh at that time. And if I recall correctly, a couple of the callers were basically saying the police are just going to take care of this guy. There is a perception out there. I'm sure you've seen the blogs too. That the trail of evidence there was pretty much deliberately fouled. How do you respond to that when people bring that up?
I don't believe that at all. I mean, there were too many people involved, and I just stand by the investigation. I really can't talk a lot about it because of the criminal.
It's ongoing. I get that.
But I believe in the integrity of the internal investigation that we had. Yeah, and again, it's been our charge since then to make sure that we do everything in our power that doesn't happen again.
would like to invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Sarah, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks.
What's your question for the chief?
Yes, I'm an advocate for victims of domestic violence, and in my work we see a very strong connection between domestic violence and general violence. Because while we want peace in the streets, I think the violence is actually starting in our homes. And I was wondering how the chief, if he sees a connection between domestic violence and general violence, and also if IMPD has any programs on the prevention side of violence.
Good question, Sarah. Thank you for calling.
That is a great question. You know, we actually have a model here, actually just right up the street, that was started maybe 10 years ago now, that creating a partnership with our domestic violence unit with the Julian Center. And that has been a wonderful opportunity really for both sides to collaborate and to work to prevent domestic violence. You know, one of the things that we're doing now is Well, the domestic violence unit, obviously, whenever there was any type of a domestic violence battery case, whatever, this unit particularly would do that. But one of the things we're looking now is we're looking at reports where maybe it's a vandalism. Maybe it's, you know, my car was – windows were smashed. I saw a prowler. Things that are repeat type minor things, if you look at one by itself, but if you look at the pattern, they are showing a pattern that might help us lead that, hey, this is going to become a domestic violence case. So we're trying to do that on the prevention side. You know, there is quite a lot of violence, whether it's between intimate partners or some type of relationship. So I think that piece and the fact that we have a domestic violence advocate on every district that is a resource that can go out either if there's an arrest or an investigation that's being done to help the victim with referrals, with shelter if necessary, to get out of that cycle of violence.
Gotten another email question from Alex, and I'm going to read it just because I don't think I can do justice to Alex's question without doing it. It says, as a Broad Ripple yuppie, it's upsetting seeing so many units on the strip waiting to make public intoxication arrests. These officers should instead be on the streets of Broad Ripple where people walking home at night are getting mugged. I have to take a cab home just 10 blocks just because of the crime. I should be able to walk. The priorities seem to be wrong here.
Okay, well, there's probably probably what you're seeing up there are there's two different groups of officers, I would say. We do have officers that are patrolling the streets, the parking lots, the alleyways, and some of the areas up there where you know, maybe might be more susceptible to a crime. But then there's also a group of officers up there that are actually off duty working as an employee from the bars. And I would guess if they're grouping up on Broad Ripple Avenue or some of those areas, that's who those officers are. So, you know, their responsibility as an off-duty officer being employed by that bar is to that bar, not necessarily patrolling the streets. Now, we make sure that they're out there and, you know, preventing the crime, preventing fights, making sure drunks don't get in the car and drive away. And they do help us prevent crime in that area.
Is there let's look at the premise of the question. I mean, are there a significant number of muggings in the Broad Ripple area?
No. I mean, not any more than any other area. You know, again, that's a very popular area, and if something does happen, we hear about it very quickly. But again, it's an area that we have a lot of police at all the time.
Megan, welcome to the program. What's your question for the chief? Megan? We will see if we can get Megan back.
Yeah, thank you. Hello.
Megan, how are you?
I work for an organization called Outreach, Inc. We work with homeless and runaway teens and young adults, a pretty high-risk population, and many of them have criminal backgrounds, of course. And more just as a comment, want to encourage what is happening. And next month, some of our youth are starting a mentorship program through a gym, through working out together, trying to break some of the barriers between our youth and IMPD, and want to encourage those things as they are happening more and more. I don't know if they get spoken about, but we're excited about those sort of things happening. So,
well, thank you for the call. That's is it unusual to get nice words like that and have somebody calling in? And
well, I think there's two things.
You're smiling.
She mentioned the homeless and then she mentioned teams. So let's start with the homeless.
Okay.
You know, we do a lot of work. Sergeant Bob Hipple from the downtown district is our main liaison with not only the homeless population but with the outreach groups that work with the homeless. And we have actually extended that. We have a homeless liaison person, I guess if you'd call them, assigned to every district that works with Sergeant Hipple downtown because, you know, typically we might see somebody on the street downtown, but it's not just a downtown issue. It happens everywhere. So, he has trained those individuals on the other districts to recognize and help and know those referrals, and I think they're doing a very good job. In terms of just like teenagers, you know, again, when I was talking earlier about, you know, engaging your police, you know, if you have a church meeting, a crime watch meeting, anything like that, an organization where you would want an officer to come and talk about, police work and engaging with the community, we would love to do that. We have any officer from the district can do that, and we have a community affairs branch also that specifically work with youth that would love to come out and talk to anyone.
We are talking with Police Chief Paul Soselski, and if you'd like to join the conversation, please call us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We actually got an email question that's somewhat complicated from a listener named Sherman. I'm going to boil down real quickly. His premise is that that there are some places where community policing seems to work very well, other places where he doesn't see much application for it. Could you first talk a little bit about what community policing is and then tackle his question? Are there places really where it doesn't work? What places does it work best in?
Well, you know, first of all, community policing is not a program. It's a philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And there we go.
Yep. Sorry.
It's a philosophy, not a program. And you know, while we have units on every district that do more in terms of problem solving and trying to go aggressively after problems in the district, you know, I consider every officer a community policing officer. In terms of places that it works well and places that it doesn't, it can work anywhere. The key to it is the community, because again, you know, we as police officers can go into any neighborhood, any area, and enforce the law or do whatever we can to try to solve problems. But until or unless the community works with us, it won't work. And I can tell you, I probably couldn't prove it statistically, but just from my own experience as a former district commander, the areas that have good crime watch, that have good neighborhood associations and work with their police and know their policemen on a first-name basis have less crime.
Dave, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks. I just wanted to ask the chief about the recent news I read in today's Star that the State House is undertaking some kind of study about the marijuana legalization issue. And I was just curious as to what the chief has to say about that and whether or not that would indeed reduce crime to have either legalization or decriminalization or anything like that. And also, as the law stands today, like how much of the police department's resources are committed to marijuana enforcement versus, more violent situations?
Thank you for the question, Dave.
Well, yeah, I'm a true believer that whether it's marijuana, cocaine, meth, whatever. I mean, that's what drives a lot of crime. From the dealer on the corner to the person who brings or distributes the drugs in here to someone on the street who, you know, breaks into a car or a home to sell something for $20 to get a rock of cocaine. So, you know, I'm not one for legalizing any type of illegal drug. I understand the medical purposes. I'm okay with that kind of stuff because obviously that has a purpose. But I don't believe if you legalize marijuana, we'd have less crime.
Just to frame the argument on the other side, play devil's advocate to draw this discussion out. In part because we have the study committee going on at the State House right now, and the laws have been liberalized, I think, in 14 other states. The argument is that, you know, prohibition really didn't work with alcohol, that we saw a spike in violent crime, that the challenge here really is seeing if we can take away the profit motive mm-hmm. for selling these drugs and giving people a reason to kill each other. Do you think that argument has any weight at all?
Yeah, I understand that. I don't think I really, I can't really dispute that. I work from my experience where, a guy on the street with a joint in his pocket, is that, is he going to go kill somebody? Probably not. Maybe it's just a recreational thing. But I'll state from my experience that, drugs drive crime.
Well, let me ask the second part of Dave's question, which I think we kind of drifted away from, which is how many resources now are being thrown by the police department at marijuana enforcement? I mean, how much of your budget or your time?
Well, we don't have a marijuana enforcement squad or detail. Any type of narcotics enforcement would come, anything from a basic traffic stop to our narcotics units who, either through tips, through arrests, through whatever, investigate whether it's marijuana, again, any type of drug. So, they'll follow up on any tip, whether it's marijuana or meth or anything. So, a drug is a drug. Right now it's illegal and we'll go after anything.
Well, and I realize part of this, it's not your job to determine what the law should be. It's to enforce
right.
it as
right.
it's written. I'd like to ask real quickly, we got a tweet from Richard who said that with consolidation over, what your biggest challenge is as police chief?
Wow, that's a good question. No one's ever asked
me
that before.
I'll talk for just a second here to let you collect your thoughts and think about it. That is a big picture question.
Mm-hmm. I think, probably the hardest thing, I've been the chief now for, 16, 17 months, and probably the hardest thing I think is just keeping morale up. The officers are out there every day working really hard through very adverse conditions. We try our best to communicate to the officers the best that we can, let them know what's going on so that they don't read something in the paper for the first time. We try to inform them of why we're making the decisions in terms of training changing our training and our policies. That's really been the biggest challenge. When we brought the IMPD and the county together, let's make no mistake on that. On the very first day, it was a very tense situation. And what was really kind of weird about it, I was a commander at the time. I had sergeants and lieutenants from the former sheriff's department that were now working for me that I had never met before, and I had been a policeman here in this county for 20 years. So here we are working in the same county. I had never met them. And I can tell you now, over four years later, are there still some hard feelings about that? Sure, there always will be. So there will always be some people who never wanted to see the IPD go away. But I can tell you this, too, that we're working very well together. You don't hear people talking about it anymore. I think everybody's focused on job one, and that's reducing violent crime.
We are talking with Indianapolis Police Chief Paul Soselski about issues of police and crime in Indianapolis. We'd invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can also send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking today with Police Chief Paul Soselski. We've gotten a lot of calls and emails, so I'm going to try to get to these as quickly as I can. And this one's just a nice comment. It's from Gary Richter. It says, I regularly walk on the Monon Trail and appreciate the increased presence of officers on the trail. Thanks for responding to this community need. Does it feel good when you hear stuff like that?
Absolutely. I personally went up there for 4 hours one day and rode the bicycle, and we've had a lot of officers up there in the last, I think we're up to 7 or 8 weeks now since we've increased our patrols. And everyone that I've talked to, every officer that I've talked to, enjoys that detail because they can't pass someone without the citizen saying, thank you, I appreciate you being out here. It's really a nice detail for the officers.
Well, and speaking of that, was it a little bit of a relief or whatever to pretty much have gotten past Black Expo this year? with relatively few problems.
Relatively is that's absolutely. I mean, it was a great weekend.
I qualified it. Yeah,
it was a great weekend, not only for the police department, but for the city. And you know what made the difference there was the community collaboration and the work that we did up front. It wasn't all the policemen down there that weekend. It was a lot of the work up front, the good messaging that we got out there, and again, it was a great weekend.
Andrew, welcome to the program.
Hi. I just had a quick question for the chief.
Yes.
With Indiana's new immigration law that's currently in the courts, if that comes through, will the IMPD have any role in enforcing that?
Good question. Thank you.
Depends on what the courts say. right now we don't. If we come across a victim of a crime that is from another country, maybe not here legally, that's not a concern of ours. We treat that case like any other. They're here. They have a right to be here, and we try to solve that crime. Now, if you're a suspect, we still treat you with all the same respect and dignity as we do anyone else. And then depending on what the crime is or conviction, ICE or somebody else gets involved. But, our focus right now is just preventing and solving crimes for anybody.
Well, let me – obviously – the law is not in effect right now because I think there's a preliminary injunction mm-hmm. in place. But let's assume that the thing stands. What would IMPD's role be in enforcing it, enforcing the law in that case as written?
It'll be difficult. It will. I mean, I don't know. We've been talking about it. We've been watching it. We haven't gotten as far yet as exactly putting a policy together. So we just have to keep watching it.
And see where it goes in mm-hmm. the courts. Gotten a question from George, a listener, says, I mostly trust police officers but have found two recent occasions where police officers appeared not to represent their profession very well. I was not involved but felt like reporting my observations. Who do we call if we witness what we think is police officer misconduct? What do you say to my anxiety toward reporting my observations, too? That's really two questions. Let's deal with the first one first. Who do they call? Who do they call if?
Well, actually, you can call the Citizens Police Complaint Office. I think it's 327-3440 is the number. Or you can call any district and ask for a supervisor, especially if it's something that's happening right now. I think I have a track record of trying to hold my officers accountable and thoroughly investigating any incidents of misconduct. And we want to hear that. We want our officers to be professional. And if anyone is on the other end of what they believe police misconduct or excessive force, we want to hear about it.
And then the second part of that question is, how do you speak to the anxiety? I mean, obviously, the perception out there is, okay, if I call and complain about a police officer, I'm going to have a parking ticket for the next, or be caught speeding every time I leave the house. So,
I would like to assure people that that's just not the case. Again, I mean, you can go to the Citizens Complaint Office and make a complaint. The officer never sees you. Do that. Either the Professional Standards Division or a district supervisor would investigate that complaint. And obviously, if something like that happened, we would look into that as well.
We've gotten a question from Chad. A listener says, it's been some time since a police reserve class has been trained. I've been on the wait list for a few years after going through the process. Is there a plan for another class? And is that a priority for the department?
Hang on, Chad. I'm trying. that was actually one of my priorities to have a reserve class. That's probably one of the hidden gems of the IMPD. We have, I think we're up to 95 reserve officers right now who have regular jobs. We have an oral surgeon. We have attorneys, all kinds of walks of life in terms of full-time professions that volunteer their time, have the same police authority that I do, and do it very, very well. In our budget tight world, a lot of people say, well, hire reserves because they're free. Well, that's true once they're trained, but to get them hired and go through the process and the medical testing and everything to get them in the academy and then to equip them also costs money. That's one of the things we're working really hard on right now, trying to find money for that as well as trying to find the money to hire another full-time merit class as well.
D, welcome to the program. What's your question for the chief?
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
First, I just want to compliment him.
Oh, I wonder if she lost her cell
connection. We need to get her back. She had a compliment.
We do, yeah. You wanted to hear that one, didn't you? Did you wanted to hear that one? Well, let me ask this: when you talk about budget constraints, and obviously we are talking in a new era now of government at all levels, but it affects police issues. As the fact that there's been an economic downturn and, you know, tax revenues have not been anywhere near as robust as they as everyone hoped they might be 3 or 4 years ago, affected the way you have to do the job?
No.
No?
Again, you know, the officer out in the street working an 8.5-hour shift, that doesn't affect him. And that's why, I mean, I'll be honest, I mean, we are having to come up with some new ideas and, you know, in terms of how to police, how to best use our resources, make sure in the right place at the right time. But, you know, we have not cut any programs. We have not cut any patrols or enforcement. So right now, I mean, we're good. You know, my hope is that we can continue to honor the budget that we're given. And again, I'd like to hire a class. So we're trying to figure out how we can do that.
Patty, welcome to the program.
You know, last year, my husband and I were victims of a home invasion. We walked into it after they had been in the house and out. When I called dispatch, I was really quite hysterical. When they came out, two cars came out. When I did contact somebody else, there was a 12-minute lapse in between when the alarm went off and an officer showed up, and I was told it was because a lot of alarms go off in houses. They can't respond to any of them. But we were victims. We could have walked in what was going on. We could have been shot. So we're really upset that the police did not respond to us any better than they did.
Thank you. Thank you for the question.
Okay, well, it's hard to answer that not knowing, you know, all the facts, obviously. And if you're still on the line, Patty, I would encourage you to call 327-3282 and give us your name, and we can look into that. When an alarm goes off in a house, it generally goes to the alarm company first. The alarm company does whatever their policy are, and then they call the dispatch center. The dispatch center then dispatches an officer. So automatically, there's a delay right there. I don't know if it'd be 12 minutes, but it's not instantaneous. So, again, if you're still listening, please call that number, and I can look into it as to why there was a delay.
Could you give the number again real quickly? Is that a number if someone feels like, you know, a police officer hasn't been sensitive to their concern or whatever that they ought to call?
Yeah, it's a general number in my office, actually. And that person that answers the phone might not be able to answer the question, but they can certainly direct anybody that's calling to the right person or to the right office. Again, it's 327-3282.
That's 327-3282. Marion, welcome to the program.
I was wondering if they have in place a program that is geared to...
Oops. Looks like we have lost Marion as well. I think where the question was going is she wanted to know if there was a program to train sort of officers for executive or leadership responsibilities. Is that the case?
That's a great question. How much more time do we have? Because I can talk on that for a while.
More than 7 minutes. So
that's one of the things that I started talking about when I became the chief is that historically, we haven't done a very good job of developing our personnel and helping to develop our future leaders. We still send people to the FBI National Academy. We have sent many of our executive staffs to the Southern Management, Senior Management Institute for Police in Boston. We have our own Career Leadership Development Office now that is developing programs to help further educate our officers. The whole training is being restructured. We have our own Leadership Academy that is a 4-week program that you have to actually apply to. That is one of our main speakers is Mr. Bill Westfall, and if you're familiar with his leadership at all. And again, as I said earlier, one of the things that we continue to do is to send people to other departments to learn their best practices. So, I mean, that is a big focus. You know, some of the things that I want to – I've been going to some of the PERF meetings, Police Executive Research Forum meetings in Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia, where you have some of the best police minds in the country that come to these meetings and talk about the future of policing. And I had never been to any of those meetings. meetings prior to being the chief. And every time I go, I say to myself, man, I really wish I could have gone to these meetings before I was the chief, you know, to meet some of these folks who are so bright in the policing world and to challenge that are challenging me to want to do a better job. And that's what we're trying to do now is identify those folks and send them to these things so that they can challenge themselves to be our future leaders.
What was the best preparation for you for a leadership role? I mean, what taught you the most or helped you get ready for this?
I think every job that I've had on the police department in my 25 years has helped, but the best job that I had was being a district commander. It's like running your own police department. I was the commander of the Northwest District. I had about 180 officers under my command, 66 square miles, which is as big as almost any other city in the state of Indiana. You manage the daily crime strategies. You manage the daily efforts of the officers. You worked in the community, did a lot of the community policing. And then if I wanted to, I could get in the car and go do a traffic stop or take a run. So it was the perfect job. And that really helped me in terms of community policing efforts, knowing what's actually happening out in the district when I then became the chief.
And how much of that do you still do? It's a little bit hard. I mean, the higher you climb and the harder it is to
stay
close.
I mean, I still have a lot of great contacts. I try to go to a lot of community meetings. I do a lot of talks. I don't get to make those personal relationships as much as I did out when I was on the district. But I go to roll calls quite often. I bring in officers in terms of focus groups all the time. I try to be as active as I can. I thoroughly enjoy it.
We've gotten a question from Rob, email question. It says, the character and culture of – that's on point here. Character and culture of an organization can be thought of as determined by the character and culture of the people atop. What are you personally intending to improve going forward about – your own approach to leading the changes required of the department? In a way, what I think what he's saying here is, you know, in what ways do you think you could still improve in the job?
Personally?
Yeah. What are the challenges for you, not just for the department?
Right. Well, again, I think, offering leadership classes to my staff, continuing to challenge them to be better, to find different ways to police. We have many of our top executive staff. I mean, they love doing research, getting on the computer and finding out what other departments are doing that might work here. And that's a great challenge, I think, for them then to see how some of those things can work here. So, I think never settle for the statement, this is the way we've always done it. Always try to push yourself to improve yourself and the department.
Dee, welcome back.
Well, thank you. I'm sorry we got cut off before.
That's okay.
I want to continue saying that I appreciate what the chief said as far as expecting the community to take a little bit of part in crime reduction, that you can't just arrest everybody. You have to try to people not go in the first place, or if they do, to try to correct them and get them out to be more productive citizens. But my main question is, I'm not completely sure that we've answered the question about where the guns come from. There's so much gun violence right now, but guns from the manufacturer to the person, whether it goes to a distributor and then it's bought legally and then goes into the illegal system, or it's bought illegally, it has to have come from somewhere originally. And just like a car, if you have a car, it's registered, you can trace it, you can find numbers on it, you can find out where it originally came from, who the first purchaser was. And although I'm a strong supporter of the right to bear arms, I think there's a huge responsibility that goes with all of our rights. And that, if a person owns a gun and the child gets hold of it, I mean, it's tragedy. There's a liability there, as far as I'm concerned, to let that happen. But at the same time, if you own a gun and Junior down the street and it takes it and does a crime with it, it's still your gun. You're liable for it. Somehow we've got to create, I think, a system where the society is more responsible for damage done by guns. And I hear people say, well, knives kill people. Knives are designed for a lot of other things too, but a gun is designed for one purpose. And so,
Dee, we're running up on time a little bit, and I want to give the chief a chance to respond to your question comment.
Yeah,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call.
Well, I like her theme in accountability, and that's really what it is. Just real quick to answer some of those questions. You know, where do guns come from? You know, obviously, some of them are stolen, some are committed by straw purchases, where someone who can legally buy it purchases it and then gives it to someone who can't legally buy it, like a convicted felon. You know, a lot of them come from burglaries. You know, people have their guns in a sock drawer rather than locked up in a safe, and the burglar will pull the drawer out, find the gun, and you know that's where we see a lot of those things come from. Many guns are not registered; they're hard to trace back to the original owner, even when we do recover them. There's a lot of work that could be done in tightening up some of these laws.
Is that the biggest problem you think right now out there in terms of crime? The sheer abundance of guns and other weapons that really make what would be a bad situation suddenly a deadly one.
I think so. Again, you know, and again for the constitutional people out there, and like Dee said, you know, I'm not against guns or people having guns. And you know, the largest majority of folks that we come across, whether it's in a traffic stop or in some type of a crime, you know, are not legally possessing these guns. So I mean, that's not the issue. You know, the issue is not anything about the Constitution. It's about the people that are not legally carrying them. How do they get them, and why are they carrying them? You know, that we talked about the Monon earlier, mm-hmm. the young man who shot that man 8 times. I think he was 14 or 16 year old. Why does he have a gun, and where did he get it? Those are the questions we need to be asking folks.
Chief Paul Soselski, thank you for being on the program. I can tell you right now the phone board is completely lit up. We've got email questions. Clearly people want to listen to you talk. Can we get you to come back sometime?
Sure, I'd love that, sure.
We've enjoyed having you here, and I think it's been a very, very good conversation. So thank you for joining us. I would like to thank all of our listeners who listened, also those who sent questions, called in. I'm sorry that we could not get to all of them because they were great questions, and this has been a very, very provocative conversation. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host for No Limits. Next week, we are going to talk about integrity in sports with local experts. So please do join us for that program. In the meantime, take care. Thanks for listening.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Matthew Sosi. We invite you to join us each Thursday at noon for No Limits, rebroadcast at 8 p.m., and you can listen online at WFYI.org.